Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robin Hood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Thanks, Marshall. Carson McCullers, great Southern Gothic American novelist, sometimes associated with the likes of Truman Capote or even Harper Lee, best known for her movies, The Cult, Reflections in a Golden Eye, and The Beloved, The Heart is the Lonely Hunter. But her most poignant work is The Member of the Wedding, which started out as a novel in 1946, and which Carson McCullers herself adapted to the stage version, in a very successful Broadway version, actually, in 1950. It's rarely revived, but it's being done so this coming month, from August 5th through August 19th at the Williamstown Theater Festival. And my guest today is its director, Gay Taylor Upchurch, known as GT. Gay Taylor Upchurch, known as GT, largely is known for adapting and directing the work of impressive young playwrights, new playwrights, in new productions. So this is a revival that she's taking on, and we're going to talk today not only about Carson McCullers, but the particular point of view that GT is bringing to it. So welcome.
Thank you. Thanks
and
for having me.
We're sitting here in an elementary school in Williamstown, Massachusetts, and I really appreciate you taking the time out of rehearsal
to
talk about this. So before we get into the play, Member of the Wedding, and what attracts you to it and how you came to this job, for people who haven't read the book, for people who haven't seen the play, but way back when, and people who haven't seen the movie, which it was made into, I think, in 1952, just set up for us so we can have a frame reference for the rest of the interview. What's the narrative premise of The Member of the Wedding?
Right. The narrative premise is that Frankie, who's 12 years old, Frankie Adams, is living in small town Georgia in 1945, and her brother, who has been on duty in the Army in Alaska, has come home with his fiance. And so the play opens, you're meeting, everyone's meeting the fiance for the first time. And when they leave the house, Frankie is left with this feeling of, what is going on with my life? I feel very out of place. I feel like a misfit. I want to be more like my brother and the bride. And basically, the novel originally interrogates adolescence and coming of age, and it's very much Frankie's coming of age story, but told alongside the story of Bernice Sadie Brown, who is the cook / childcare nanny of the Adams family, and
the black maid,
yeah.
And in the old parlance, yeah,
that's right. And she and Frankie have a really special relationship. And John Henry West, who is the 7-year-old cousin, also hangs around in the kitchen with them all summer. And so we're nearing the end of the summer, and they've been in this kitchen for days and days and days with each other. And that's when the play opens.
All right. So, is this the first revival you've done of a major American play?
It is. I did a revival of She Loves Me,
musical,
82, which was a blast. But yes, this is my first revival of a major American play.
Okay. Yeah. We see a lot of revivals. One of the hottest directors in the world is Ivo van Hove, and
yes,
he's sort of he's broken down the wall for all kinds of really, really broad reinterpretations of classics. We saw a different twist on one up here at Williamstown Theater Festival a couple of years ago with the Eugene O'Neill play, the one about the Irish family's farming family up in Connecticut.
Right.
It was with Audra McDonald.
With Moon for the Misbegotten.
Yes. So my question is, are you playing this straight, going back to the 1950 script and book, or are you making any revisions or adapting it in any kind of way that might make it
with
more now?
Yeah. Well, Carson McCullers' writing really lends itself to feeling right now. Even though she wrote it, the novel came out in 1946, and she adapted the play soon after that. It, when you read it, and particularly in the mouths of these actors, it sounds like it could have been written yesterday, mm-hmm, but set in 1945. So design-wise and the approach to acting has been very much to yes, keep it, you know, absolutely, it's important that it's set in 1945. So we've done a lot of period research so that we know exactly what that is. But then we've made decisions so that it feels more now. It doesn't feel like a museum piece. So the set is, they're in a kitchen, which is everything in the kitchen is, you know, from 1945 or 30s, things that would have been in the kitchen at that time. So the type of stove and sink, et cetera, is all very researched, the ice box. But the style of the kitchen, it's very simple. The lines are very clean. The color palette is mostly white with touches of color. So we've kept it in a world in which it's not a far leap. You don't look at it and automatically think, ooh, you know, musty period play. That I think it feels very fresh. And Lars Jelinek is the scenic designer, and the set is really beautiful and has an abstraction in the sort of what you're looking at in the background is a clapboard white wall, which is what a lot of the houses in the South were made of. But you look at the wall on the set, and it's clear that it's not exactly the house next door, and it's not exactly just a clapboard wall, but it's also not exactly the horizon line. You know, so it's a playing space that has been manipulated with an emotional gesture and something that takes us slightly outside of just realism.
So which came first, the chicken or the egg? Did the set designer come up with this kind of vision of what he thought this world was about, or did you, in concert with him, relay your vision of the world that he's articulated with this particular set?
Right. Well, I would say she was in conversation, and this is actually the conversation started out of the research drawings that she found, again, of a lot of clapboard houses, et cetera, and then knowing that she didn't want it to be a totally realistic space, started manipulating ideas for how to live outside of that. Right. And the play takes place, you need a kitchen, you need a yard. So there were a couple of things that we knew that had to be there. But in question was, well, what else can you be looking at that right. takes us outside of just kitchen sink drama?
In case you're just joining us, the program is Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. It's on Robin Hood Radio. And my guest today is Gay Taylor Upchurch, otherwise known as GT, who's directing The Revival, an uncommon revival of The Member of the Wedding at the Williamstown Theater Festival from August 5th through August 19th. Your protagonist,
Frankie.
And Bernice. Oh, that's my next question. A couple of questions about this.
Yes.
You've got really two protagonists in a way.
Yes.
And I did read an interview you gave a couple of years ago how you really liked working with female protagonists.
I do.
I sort of can't imagine a bigger challenge than a 12-year-old complicated pubescent young woman and a black maid who's looking at her life on the cusp of the civil rights movement.
Right. They're both fascinating characters, and McCullers drew them both really sharply and fully fleshed out. In fact, Richard Wright at the time when he read Member of the Wedding said, who is this white writer who's able to, you know, write people of color so well? And McCullers was really interested in race relations in the South. And it's interesting to me that it's extraordinary, really, that she was writing about it in this way to say, look at this person who is fully human and fully capable of the deep, deep love and big struggles in her life and still is, you know, she's this woman in her 40s and she's still very viable sexually and has all of these other things going on in the text. And how, you know, how is it that we're treating them in this segregated, you know, Jim Crow South? And the civil rights movement didn't really take hold until the lynching of Emmett Till in 1955. So McCullers was really looking at this as a Southerner with, I think, a very prescient lens on, you know, figuring out what those relations
were. Would
you
say almost a progressive lens?
Yes, yeah. I would. Yeah. I would. Yeah. Yeah, she was. And in fact, when she moved to New York, she used to say she would return to the South only when she needed to renew her sense of horror because she was so disgusted by the treatment of blacks at that time.
In your last response to the topic that I threw out, you mentioned sexuality and Carson McCullers. Let's not forget that. Get back to it before the end of the interview. But I don't want to leave unremarked by you, what's it like working with a juvenile actress.
Right.
Have you worked with, I don't want to say kids, but have you worked with young actresses before? How old, or maybe I don't even want to ask.
I shouldn't
ask how old the actress is who's playing Frankie, because that is irrelevant. But have you worked with younger people who are taking on roles of juveniles?
I have worked with younger people before. I will say that the youngest member of the cast is playing John Henry West, mm-hmm. and that is the largest role that I've worked with a young person on before, and I will say he is extraordinary,
right.
And is able to just take on board so much. And the woman playing Frankie is Tavi Gevinson, and she was on stage actually in an Ivo Van Hove show, The Crucible, on Broadway recently.
Yeah,
she
wonderful.
Played one of the schoolgirls, and she's amazing, and is able to, you know, she's not a child herself, but she's able to channel that and find a physicality that I think is really remarkably authentic mm-hmm. and feels very true mm-hmm. to this 12-year-old girl.
Okay. You just mentioned physicality.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I know from doing a little bit of research that you started out, before you went to theater school and started this career in directing, as a dancer.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So if you take a story like Carson McCullers, The Member of the Wedding, which is mm-hmm. largely about internal growth, right?
Right.
Okay. How do you, with someone who was trained as a dancer, look at this stagescape, look at these characters that are really internally driven, and create motion
yeah.
on the stage?
That's a great question. I think my dance background, you know, I feel like in dance, a lot of it is about finding tension in line of the body and where things, you know, where people are being placed on stage. And I think that staging theater is not so very different from that, in that what you're after is finding the tension in a scene. And a lot of times moving someone a foot closer, a foot farther away can make all the difference. And this kitchen is very small. We made it the size of an actual kitchen, which on stage it first appears small, but the fantastic thing about it is that it forces us into this kind of rhythm in the kitchen of there's not a ton of places for them to go or to hide or to get away from each other, which I think feels very true for a
right,
hot
but,
summer.
But also in American life, a lot of stuff
exactly.
gets transacted
yes,
or not over yes. the kitchen table.
That's
right?
exactly true, yeah.
yeah.
And so it's been a really fun challenge for me to find, you know, how can we use, you know, we have two kids in the play, so a lot of things take place under the table, or, you know, how are they sitting in the chairs, how are they moving around the table, who can hang out in the doorway, as McCullers describes Frankie as being somebody who's in this liminal stage of her life, and she hangs out in doorways a lot. What does that mean? So we were able to...
Coming or going?
Exactly.
Doesn't know where she is? Is she
exactly
in?
Right.
Is she out? I don't know. I'm just... Your
yeah.
suggestion just brought that to mind.
Yeah. yeah. No, that's exactly right. So finding... staging that sits well with those kind of physical metaphors.
Just picking up the kinds of vocabulary you're using to describe to describe the member of the wedding, particularly focusing on Bernice mm-hmm. and Frankie, what's coming into my head right now is the word otherness.
Mm. Yeah. That's great. I, you know, McCullers herself, I think, felt like a misfit in the
yeah.
South and wanted to get out. And I think she's instilled in both of those characters a feeling of being misfit. You know, Bernice has lost an eye. The play opens. She's wearing an eye patch. She's also a black woman in the South in 1945. Frankie has...
And she has... You mentioned before she has a sexual life.
She does. She does. Very much. She talks about her four husbands very freely with the children. And also she's going on a date at the end of the first act. So there's a man in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not sure that she's actually satisfied with him. There may be more to come. So
mm-hmm.
she is, she's very much in her prime.
And how does this contrast with Frankie's pubescent sexuality?
So Frankie spends a lot of the play denying that sex exists at all.
Mm-hmm.
And
is she tomboyish?
She is. So she's just cut off all of her hair, which she talks about in the play, and she dresses like a boy. And so she's clearly starting to struggle with her own sexual identity, which she doesn't have anything to reflect back to her what that could possibly be. And it's clear that she's going to either be lesbian or bisexual or something, that she's going to be facing her own sexual identity as the play progresses. I mean, as her life progresses, but that's, you know, before the end of the play. But she... what we do is we get glimpses of other girls from the neighborhood who are all in dresses with long hair, and so she doesn't fit in. She feels like a misfit, an outcast herself. And in fact, there's a whole section where she ponders about the freaks at the fair, and it's clear that she feels more of a connection to them in a way, in terms of where she might end up.
Does this dovetail with any of the research that you did on Carson McCullers?
It does. It does. It checks out for sure. She felt destined for greater things from this small town in Georgia from the beginning, as does Frankie. She feels a restlessness. She feels like she wants to get out, that there must be other people like her. McCullers, although she married Reeves McCullers, was very much interested in women. And there's some speculation that some of those relationships didn't pan out. In other words, she would fall in love with women that were unattainable, or at least want to be with women that were unattainable. But
sort of an unrequited sexual expression with women.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So she was struggling with that herself.
One of the critics that I read about before coming here today was that said that Carson McCullers wrote against heterosexuality.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I understand that. Yeah. In the play, she certainly observes other heteronormative relationships and then kind of checks out herself in response to that, including, you know, Janice and Jarvis, her brother and his fiance. That sort of sets this whole thing off.
Does Frankie remind you at all of Scout?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I can see that for sure.
Yeah, the tomboy, the kind of, you know, the misfit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's a similarity.
Uh-huh, right. What's the biggest challenge with this piece, with this play?
The biggest challenge is it might be what I mentioned earlier, that we are in this kitchen and how to carve out the moments. It's written unity of time and place, which I love and also makes it challenging. In other words, the first act, you are with them in real time. And the second act is also you're with them in real time. In other words, there's not scene breaks to say, okay, that's so now we know what that beat is. Let's have a transition. We'll move forward. You are spending unbroken time with these people. And it's so satisfying when we get it right in the rehearsal room. And then it's the challenges, carving out and tracking and making sure that we calibrate the energy and the tension correctly so that the story is understood. And it's just a delicate balance when you're doing it, you know, in real time.
Right. In case you're just joining us, the program is Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. We're talking about Carson McCullers, The Memoir of the Wedding, which is getting an uncommon and rare revival at Williamstown Theater Festival August 5th through 19th. And I'm talking today with Gay Taylor Upchurch, known as GT, who's the director of the play. So, GT, let's talk about women directing.
Okay.
Are there enough of them? Should there be more? And if so, how do we get more?
Right. I mean, I think there can always be more. There's always room for more people at the table.
More members of Congress, more members of Senate,
exactly.
More even the boardroom.
There should be room for however many people choose to go into this and stick with it. I think that right now the challenge for women has been to be directing on larger stages. That there are a lot of women directors now who have gained a lot of ground and some attention. And then where the numbers, where you see the numbers diminish are on the Broadway stages and on larger.
And that sort of, if I may, that sort of comes through in your own resume. And you've got an incredible resume of working with the best and the finest regional theaters and workshops and writers' programs around the country, but you don't have a Broadway credit, right?
This is true.
When you go to the Broadway stage, you can count the number. Well, there's one up here at Williamstown Theater Festival directing Limpika, who directed Natasha.
Rachel Chapkin. She's fantastic.
So she's one that we can think of.
There have been a lot. Well,
yeah.
I also look at people like Annie Kaufman, who's one of my favorite directors around, and she's been directing, you know, for years with and has had so many hits off Broadway. And had her first Broadway show, I think it's been a year ago now, which is fantastic. But didn't that happen earlier? Celia Weston. It was really great. It was the Marvin's Room.
Oh yes,
Marvin's Room.
Yep.
Roundabout.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So you do think? Well, yes. I would be interested to see what Annie Kaufman would be doing with Broadway resources again soon.
So, right.
You know.
How did you? This is a corny question. I always ask people, what's the first piece of theater you ever saw, and what was the first Broadway play that you saw?
Oh, well, that may be one of the same. I grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, where there's not a lot of theater.
So you do have a perspective on Southern
women.
Now the little accent comes out a little bit. Okay.
Yes. I mean, yes. So working on Remember the Wedding has been really close to my heart. But my dad actually lived in New York, and I visited him, and he took me to see Annie on Broadway. So my first big play experience was actually the musical Annie on Broadway, which I loved.
How old were you?
I was seven.
Yeah. Okay.
Did
you want to be up there on the stage with all those little girls?
No, I didn't. Okay. But I loved it. I remember being terrified of Miss Hannigan and having that kind of reaction. But, you know, it didn't occur to me at the time or later that could be a job. Do you know what I mean? I loved it, but it didn't strike me as something that, you know, one could do with their life. That said, of course, I was, simultaneously at that time, even already taking dance classes and wanting to do that. So then my next trips to New York, I saw a ton of dance is what I started doing. Right. So the play that I saw that made me think, oh, directing is interesting, or going into a life of the theater would be interesting. The first one that I saw was, that I had a real experience with was Chris Shin's 4, which was being done, I think it must have been like the year 2000 or something, at the Worth Street Theater. And it was a tiny black box theater.
Where's this?
It was downtown. I think it disappeared after 9/11. And it was, you know, I was so moved. And in this tiny, you know, maybe it was like 60 people. I don't know. And I thought, oh, wow, this is worth investigating. This is amazing. And at the time, I had stopped dancing and was really missing the performing arts. And that was sort of my first thought of maybe looking into what theater had to offer. Mm-hmm. And then I saw The Invention of Love, Tom Stoppard's The Invention of Love, which Jack O'Brien directed in this like sweeping theatrical way, but with intimate scenes that were
incredible.
So realistic. And that was my first time I was aware of a director's hand,
right.
And that got me interested in this profession.
Do you think plays should show a director's hand? Or
do
Not you think
necessarily.
The director's hand should be invisible? Some directors say that's the ultimate compliment.
Yeah, I think that's the ultimate compliment. Yeah. Because the plays that I get swept away in, I'm not so aware of the directing itself. I mean, I am now in a way of, you know, if I'm getting swept away in a play of complete admiration, then I, you know, you're not so aware of it as you're watching it. But that's a real
trick. So does an alarm bell go off in your head, or do you have to sometimes stop yourself when you're directing and say, wait a minute, that's not what the play, I'm not being true to the text here. We're getting away from the text.
When I'm directing. Yes. I mean, I think as a director in the room, I often put myself in the position of the audience. So when I'm watching a scene playback or a stumble through or run through, that I have in my mind, okay, if this is my first time experiencing this moment with these actors, what story is being told? Am I understanding what I'm watching?
Right.
And is it holding my attention?
And if it doesn't, do you go back to the text?
Often, yes, because I do think, you know, that my directing teacher was Gerald Friedman, and that was always his, you know, everything you need to know is in the text.
Keep going back to it.
Yeah. And sometimes it can also be, I would say, text plus imagination. You know, I think sometimes you have to, which is why I think it's important to see things other than theater, to go to art museums and see other kinds of art, because you can that way kind of fill up your spiritual imagery and things that as a director you draw on for fresh ideas as you're reading a text.
You mentioned in another interview you did some time ago that your favorite play was Annie Baker's The Aliens.
Oh, yeah. I love that play.
You know, it's going to be done right here down the road.
Oh, is it?
Over the River and Through the Woods.
Oh, that's great.
Daniel Elihu Kramer
is so good. Don't miss it.
He's doing it at Chester.
Daniel Kramer is. Oh, wow.
In a couple of weeks.
Amazing.
Working with actors, you who spent time as a dancer, do you sometimes have to look at an actor and say they don't move,
and ask them not to move,
or to look at an actor and I mean I went to a play the other night and it was a large company and it was a musical and there was a lot of dancing and movement but not so much dancing just a lot of movement and there were two kids in the play who couldn't move. And I said, how can this be? I mean, do you sometimes see that and say, oh, boy.
I haven't had that experience because I will say when I've had the good fortune of working on a musical, there's been an embarrassment of riches of people that can do, you know, those things. I mean, certainly, you know, in in casting. I mean, who knows how that happens, or maybe that character wasn't originally dancing, and then if as you're working on something, suddenly there's a dance that gets added, or, you know, so those things can happen. I don't know. I once worked with Donald Sadler, who's this amazing dancer choreographer, who said that he often choreographs to sort of the choreographs the lead, and if the lead is a weak mover, then it's okay. He comes up with ways to make everyone still be able to move, and that person still looks amazing on stage. And I do think there's an elegance in it.
So there's a rhythm to the whole,
stage. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. Did you cast this, or did you, or had it been cast?
It had been cast. So there were a couple people that I got to audition, but for the most part, and the leads had been cast.
Right.
Yeah, and I feel really fortunate because they're all amazing.
Right. Okay, so a final question, because you've had an interesting journey. A nice young woman from the South comes to New York, goes to dance school, decides, hey, I want to direct. What kind of advice do you give any young person, or specifically a young woman, who wants to do something that she might not have been raised to do? Let's put it that way.
Oh, right. You mean anything in life?
Yeah. Or directing. How do young women into theater in ways that they want to do it? Let's put it that way.
Yeah. I mean, this may not be directed towards young women. This may be for anyone. But I would say it's important to steep yourself in that community. So at the beginning, I saw as much theater as I could. I talked to as many people as I could. I hung out at places like New Dramatists, where new writers are coming in, and there's a free library where you can sit and read however many plays you want. And so that I got to understand the world that I was entering. And because what you want to do is find your place in it, you know, like what you think you're drawn to and what you might be good at. So for me, I mean, perhaps that's why I started doing a lot of new plays. I was meeting a lot of new playwrights and forging partnerships with them. And then we eventually got to, you know, start producing, you know, start actually doing productions.
Right.
But I think getting to know the world that you're entering is a great beginning. Just finding out as much as you can. I mean, I definitely sat down for coffee with a lot of people and asked questions.
Sure, yeah. I think we have time for one more question too.
Okay.
You also took a lot of international time to do this.
Yes, I did. I was associate director on the Bridge Project, which was a co-production between BAM and the Old Vic, and Sam Mendes directed several Shakespeare's and Chekhov's, and I was his associate on that. And part of my job was to tour with those companies for about 10 months a year, putting up those plays in different cities all over the world. And it was a huge experience and education for me.
So everywhere from opera houses to black boxes and all
that's
different
right, that's right.
Places.
Yes, we were in like jewel boxes in Madrid and Paris.
Wow.
And in massive spaces in Hong Kong and Auckland and Singapore. Yeah, all over. It was fantastic.
And here you are now in Williamstown on the stage of the
yes.
Williamstown Theater Festival.
Yes.
Congratulations on that, and best of wishes with the member of the wedding.
Thank you.
Beginning August 5th and continuing through August 19th. And again, I thank you, Chiti, for
Thanks.
Taking the time out of the rehearsal schedule to talk to us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening, everyone. If you've enjoyed what you've heard on Off Script and the other programs on Robin Hood Radio, please go to robinhoodradio.com, go to the support tab, and express your appreciation. I would appreciate that, as I know Jill and Marshall at the station will too. So thanks again to GT, Gay, Taylor, Upchurch for joining us today. Again, the member of the wedding at the Williamstown Theater Festival starting August 5th. I'm Dan Dwyer. This has been Off Script. Until the next time, be well.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand, and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.